Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Friday, August 28th, 2020. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal, the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Oh, folks, I have such mixed feelings right now. It is the final day of my vacation. The endless summer is over. Now it's back to more quarantining and not sending my kid to school on a regular basis, like we do every year that we're living in the midst of a pandemic. But why do I have mixed feelings? Because on the other end of that, I have a great interview for you today that I recorded about a week and a half ago, with Sayward Darby. She's the editor-in-chief of the Atavis magazine. She has written a book, Sisters in Hate, American Women on the Front Lines of White Nationalism. It is I don't know if you would call this an ethnography. I didn't ask her that. But it's really like, it's a story of hate groups, but it's told through basically three women, not basically, but told through three women who are white nationalists. They're all slightly differently situated. One of them, Lana Lotkiff, I think is her name. You know, I had talked about, and I mentioned this to her in the interview, so I'm not going to go over it again, but too much. But years ago, I had mentioned, like, I'm really worried because my daughter at the time was into makeup tutorials. And she would do these makeup tutorials, and, you know, I never really gave it much thought. It was like, oh, and for a while, actually, Mila had a real issue with, like, everything was like she was talking to YouTube. So everything was like, hey guys, how you doing? And she would be doing this into the mirror. She would be doing it like at the breakfast table and this and that. And I wouldn't ever let her have a YouTube show because I didn't want anybody creeping on her or anything like that. But I saw this Lana Lotkiff do a, like, you know, cause I don't know how I ended up there. Do a show that, like, appeared to be like a makeup tutorial show. And then it also turns out she's a white supremacist. So that really scared me. And I don't think I ever, like, did anything about it, but I remember talking about it in the show, and then she pops up in this book. So it's fascinating stuff. Folks, the RNC has wrapped up, I believe. And today will be the last day that Nomi does her 3 p.m., wrap up of the RNC. I may jump on YouTube today and do a little bit of wrap up my own. And if I do, I will, I'll put out a notice on the app at majorityapp.com. You can check it out. And keep an eye out for that. You pick it up at majorityapp.com, iOS and Android app. Of course, AM Quickie, hopefully you listen to it all this week, amquickie.com, got your news updated. Brief word from a sponsor, and this episode in particular is brought to you by Magic Spoon. As you recall, breakfast cereal, one of the best things about being a kid. I got to be honest with you, though. I still eat breakfast cereal. I eat it at all times of the day. Sometimes I have it in the middle of the night. But it's like comfort food. It's comfort food. And of course, you know, back in the day, you ate really sugary, comfort food. And then you realize as an adult, like you realize that all your favorites are full of junk and sugar and all that mess. Well, Magic Spoon is a new cereal company that's discovered a way to recreate your favorite childhood cereals. With you ready for this? Zero sugar. 11 grams of protein and only 3 net grams of carbs in each serving. I'm not exactly sure how that works because what they do is they subtract it based on the fiber and the other thing, whatever. Magic Spoon offers 4 flavors based on the all-time classics, cocoa, fruity, frosted, and blueberry, plus a variety pack that lets you try them all. Now listen, I'm recording this last week. I know it's going to freak you out, but I'm recording this in the past. I'm talking into the future. Now, you know, many of you listen to it as a recording anyway, so it's not that big of a deal. But my point is that I'm getting ready to head to the beach with my kids. I don't want to go shopping, you know, when I get down there. I want to basically stay, you know, a little bit quarantine-y. And I ordered a bunch of Magic Spoon because my kids love the cereal. They love it. I'm a big fan of the cocoa. Saul loves the fruity and the frosted. Blueberry, Mila likes a little bit. But it's really, we are a cocoa, fruity, and frosted family. Then they have recreated the taste and texture of these classic sugary cereals. But you'd never guess it was healthy. And my kids love it. My kids love the cereal. It's keto friendly. It's gluten free. It's grain free. It's soy free. It's low carb and it's GMO free. And I'm you know, 2 or 3 times a week now, I'm getting a bowl of cereal and I'm just thinking like, it's delicious, but I'm not really sort of screwing up. I'm still staying healthy. But when your kids love something that's healthy, there is no, that is it. That is, you've reached the peak, the pinnacle. Believe me, I've turned a lot of people onto Magic Spoon. I mean, I guess on the show, but I'm saying like in my, you know, personal life. It's weird. It's weird to say there's a cereal you should try, but I don't know. Go to magicspoon.com/majorityreport to grab a variety pack. Try it today. Use promo code MajorityReport at checkout to get free shipping. Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed with 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. That's magicspoon.com/majorityreport. Code MajorityReport for free shipping. Check it out, folks. Honestly, delicious cereal. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we do, we're going to come back with Sayward Darby. On her book, Sisters in Hate, American Women on the Front Lines of White Nationalism. We will be back with the show live on Monday of next week. Monday, we're going to do a news day. Tuesday, we're going to talk to Rick Perlstein. We're going for it now, man. We're back. It's not quite post-Labor Day yet, but it's going to have a post-Labor Day energy around here, believe me. Believe me. All right, quick break. Stick around. You'll enjoy this interview. Right back after this. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program the editor-in-chief of the Atavist magazine, the author of Sisters in Hate, American Women on the Front Lines of White Nationalism, Sayward Darby. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
I got to tell you, I'm fascinated by this. I have a 15-year-old daughter, and I came across one of the 3 women that you profile, essentially, in this book. And we should say this is based upon off of your Harper's article. Lana Lochteff, sorry. Mm-hmm. I stumbled upon her, I don't know, maybe it was like 5 or 6 years ago, and I was terrified because she's doing these videos, and, you know, some of the videos that she would do were sort of more explicit white supremacist, but the other videos that she was doing were like basically like makeup tutorials. And I became really alarmed at the you know, how effective this might end up being. Why don't we start with this? Just why, what made you look into this specific, I guess, cohort of white supremacists?
Yeah, it started out with, you know, sort of a basic curiosity. After the 2016 election, you know, there was coverage of the so-called alt-right, and people were certainly very upset about the way that they had supported Trump's candidacy and were now, you know, excited by the victory, and were sort of coming out of the shadows, if you will. And I was struck by the fact that there were no women described or quoted in the coverage of the alt-right. And it just didn't seem correct to me that there would be no women whatsoever. So I went looking for them. And it just really kind of spiraled, for lack of a better word, from there. Because, you know, once I found one, I found more. And once I found more, I found, you know, this long history that I was unaware of, that I think most people are unaware of the ways that women have contributed to hate in America.
I mean, let's talk a little bit about that history before we get into, you know, what you found when you profiled these three women. The height of, and I go here, I'm not sure if this is really the height of women's participation or maybe even the most relevant participation of women in white supremacy, at least in the context of this country. But back in the KKK had a resurgence in the in the Jim Crow era and the 1910s and up to 20. I think the peak, it was in 1920. There was something like 6 million plus card-carrying members, literally, of the KKK. And the WKKK, the women's KKK, had like half of the membership was women.
Yeah, it was a remarkably powerful organization and a large organization. And I think when people think of the KKK, they tend to think of the very first iteration of it immediately after the war, the Civil War, when, you know, it was, I mean, it always has been a terrorist organization. But I think that people don't remember it as more of a political and strategic organization that it ultimately became in the era that you're talking about. I think they imagine, you know, people riding around on horses, committing violence, which again, definitely happened. But then by, you know, the post-World War I period, they were very actively involved in politics. Women, certainly after winning the right to vote, there were women in the WKKK who used their newfound suffrage to, you know, support politicians and policies that reflected their organization's worldview. And, you know, it ultimately did dwindle, the organization, not that it went away, it still exists, obviously, but there was this moment in time when it was very powerful. And I don't think the fact that the organization itself ultimately, you know, downsized, got smaller, got less powerful, means that the things that it supported and asked for its members to support, I don't think that went anywhere, ideologically speaking. So, you know, I think that's one reason that when we talk about hate and we think very strictly about groups, like the number of hate groups or the size of hate groups, that's certainly one way of measuring things. But the ideology of hate and you know, the forces of American culture that it draws on are always there. You know, the KKK may have gotten smaller, but that doesn't mean that it didn't matter anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, so I mean, I guess it's, you know, like you say, it's a function of metrics. And I am a firm believer that the ladder in which you discuss the ideology has been as durable and vigorous as it could be throughout that time. How it is transmitted, I mean, it's almost, maybe I've got, you know, the example of a virus on the mind for whatever reason right now.
Can't imagine why.
but the virus is out there, and it's just that there are times where more people are, you know, I guess, symptomatic than others. And where are we, to the extent that you can actually measure this? Because I know we have about, 1,000 hate groups in the country at this point. I don't know. I mean, I think that's like, mm-hmm, a specific number. Where are we, relatively speaking, to where we've been?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, and it is really hard to quantify. And you're correct about the number of hate groups. I believe that the Southern Poverty Law Center, you know, is tracking close to 1,000. I want to say in their most recent report, the number was like 954 or something. And it's probably freakish that I remember things like that. But, you know, I think that that is certainly an important metric because that's a lot of groups. and they, you know, have a variety of, you know, different forms and different, you know, sort of some are more neo-Nazi, some are more neo-Confederate. And, you know, keeping an eye on that is so important. But then especially in the digital era, I think there are so many people who, you know, are interested in quote unquote alternative news, interested in, you know, understanding what's going on in the world, you know, seeking to understand their place in it. And they might find and latch on to white nationalism as a movement, as an ideology, but not necessarily be a card-carrying member of any particular group. So you mentioned the example of Lana Loktef, and she and her husband run something called Red Ice, which is a white nationalist media platform. And, you know, everybody who watches Red Ice videos are not necessarily also members of a group that the Southern Poverty Law Center is tracking, but they might support and believe, agree with, feel like they're learning things from, you know, the falsehoods and bigotry that Red Ice is promoting. And so I think that in this particular moment, you know, immediately after Obama's election, in 2008, we saw a big uptick in chatter, recruitment, and just sort of general far right sentiment, particularly online. And again, there was a surge after the advent of Black Lives Matter in the 2012 to 2014 period. And then certainly, you know, with Trump's election, we saw that again. And I think there's something happening right now, that in some ways, like the wave is just picking up, and what that will actually look like remains to be seen. But I think that, the combination of the election this fall, the pandemic throwing so much in our lives into an uncertain place, and then also the, you know, resurgence of Black Lives Matter in the streets, going out, you know, to protest in this like sustained way, you know, the far right feeds off of that kind of uncertainty, instability, and also, you know, things that make them uncomfortable, because I would not in any way describe Black Lives Matter as like an unstable force. I think it's a very exciting, and very progressive force, but for some people, it makes them very uncomfortable. So, so I think that, you know, white nationalism is and always has been an exaggeration of white supremacy that, you know, exists across the country. That is right. Like the baseline norm. And it feeds on that all the time. And then the additional ingredients are things like the instability or uncertainty that I'm describing. So, you know, I think the election is obviously a huge question mark, in terms of how it will go and then also how, you know, the far right will react to whatever the outcome is. But I think it is it's a really, scary moment in a lot of ways. I mean, I tend to be more pessimistic about this than some people, but, you know, there's also been research showing, and I talk about this in my book, there's been political science research in the last few years showing that a sense of white identity as an actual race has been, as an actual racial group, has been concretizing over the last few years, decades. And, you know, demographics in the country are changing, and not only is a sense of white identity concretizing, but a sense of disenchantment with the status of white people as a group is concretizing and growing. And that doesn't necessarily mean that everybody who, as a white person, says, I now identify as part of this group and I also do not like my position in the country, that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, that they become a bigoted person or act in a bigoted way, but it certainly means that they can, and that the far right is poised to exploit that feeling and those grievances. So, you know, the 21st century in a lot of ways, all of the change and all of the diversity that we see in the country, you know, doesn't necessarily, I guess the best way to describe it, and I think I said this at one point, I wrote a excerpt from the book in the New York Times, and the exact moments where some people take hope, in what's happening in the country, other people turn to hate. And I think that what we're seeing in 2020 is very much that.
Interesting. And do me a favor. What is concretizing? I'm sorry. I'm not familiar with that.
Oh, I'm making up words, which would be great.
I have no problem with that either. Cause I will use it. But what does it mean in that context?
Yeah. In that context, it means that, it's sort of solidifying and clarifying. And so, you know, whiteness is a construct. It's not it's a measure of power. It's a measure of privilege. And who counts as white has shifted a great deal over time.
Right.
You know, it depended on, you know, what country you were from, depended on what language you spoke. It depended on, you know, what your religious beliefs were, all these kinds of things.
Yes.
And what we're seeing now, and I highly recommend, there's this political scientist, Ashley Jardina, who's at Duke University, and she wrote a book called White Identity Politics, where she talks about this, is that people who are white are increasingly identifying as such, and saying, like, I am, they are defining an identity and a group in a way, and identifying as part of that in a way that they had not necessarily before.
That's fascinating. And part of that is the dynamic of, you know, when you are the dominant culture, you don't even perceive yourself as anything. You just say, like, I'm normal. Everything, and as whiteness becomes less dominant in the context of society, you're saying that there are two different reactions to this. One is people are like, this is progress, and we are a multiracial society, and these constructs are constructs, et cetera, et cetera. And others go the opposite direction, which is I am now going to perceive myself as walking through the world as white. And that involves, it seems to me, a lot of, and we're going to get to the women aspect. I mean, at this point, we're just sort of like in sort of the general, but I do want to get into the specifics of it, but I think it's important to have this sort of basic framework. But the reaction to the loss of social status on some level, right? I mean, this is an ongoing argument that we have on this program on some level that, speaking as a white guy, when I was a kid, I watched TV. Everything I would watch on TV in some way was a reflection of my experience. It was either about my mom, and she was showed up as a mom, or as my wife. You know, she would show up as a wife to someone like me, or I would see someone just like me in the center of whatever it was, television commercial or TV. I mean, in books and whatnot, and as that goes away, suddenly there has to be a sense of, I mean, the fact is that to the extent that people identify as being black in our society, a big part of that is a function of our society always reminding them that they are black, because of the way that our society interacts with them on some level.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are other aspects of it, of course, but for a white person to have that sense, they really have to sort of create a narrative of aggrievement on some level.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that, you know, white nationalism is all about a narrative, right? And they have people who have been in this movement, you know, for longer than some of the folks that are just coming to it on the internet. You know, they've been suggesting this since, you know, gosh, going back so far, you know, to when there really was no question of, you know, who the dominant group, who the dominant people in the country were. And yet they were constantly saying, you know, the white race is under threat. They're coming for us. You know, we need to fight our enemies. We need to preserve, you know, the white future of this country. And that's something that they're saying again today. They've always said it. They repeat themselves a great deal. I think that they are, also drawing on, here's a good example. You mentioned, you know, all the TV advertisements, and that kind of thing. They point that out all the time now, but instead, and Red Ice does this even, you know, they'll show a panel of, you know, here are a bunch of ads for clothes, and they're quick to point out that none of them are all white. that, you know, there is diversity in all of these advertisements, which, you know, I take as progress. They take, and they will say that it is evidence of like an anti-white agenda, that we are being inculcated as a society with this notion that multiculturalism is better, that diversity is better, when in fact it's dangerous. And they'll, you know, they have all these fallacious, and, you know, arguments, and then also just lies about, about, you know, why that worldview, makes sense to them. And I think that that's precisely what you're talking about is, you know, trying to muster evidence for grievance and for this narrative that white people are being disrespected. They're being, you know, frankly, the white nationalists will say that white people are the real targets of racism in this country, which is so laughable. And yet, like, that's the narrative that they are spinning every single day. And the internet is just full of this. Right. If you, you know, peel back, you don't even have to peel back the surface a lot of the time. you know, it's right there, on Twitter, on YouTube, Facebook, just everywhere.
So, all right. So where do women traditionally fall within a white nationalist movement? And then we'll get to these three women that you specifically followed, because it in sort of juxtapose how they perceive themselves falling into that narrative, into that, I guess, ideology. I mean, there is it's rather hierarchical, isn't it? I mean, by definition.
Yeah, no. I mean, it's interesting. Like, I think that there are a couple of assumptions about the far right with regard to gender that are important to dispel. And one is, you know, certainly that this is all angry white men. And that, you know, if there are women, they have somehow been dragged into it, you know, they're abused in some way, which is not to say that that does not happen. But I think it takes away the agency of women who are in this space. And, you know, in the case of the three women in my book that I focus on, and then there are a number of other women who I, you know, interviewed or talk about in the book in shorter form, they all came to the movement of their own accord. And so I think like a very important assumption to kind of do away with first and foremost is that like a woman who is in this movement must be under duress in some way, and, you know, under the thumb of a man or something. So that's an important thing to say right out. And then, you know, women get into white nationalism for the same reasons men do. They're looking for power. They're looking for a community. They're looking for validation. They are, you know, really seeking something that white nationalism and the narrative that it spins, you know, promises to provide them. And in the space, they, you know, certainly are valorized as, you know, mothers of the race. So, you know, your ability to have children is so vitally important, because, you know, without white babies, there will be no white race is the argument. And so they are told by virtue of their biology and their aesthetics that they are important and they are powerful. And so that's something that you see a lot of this kind of cult of white motherhood and, you know, the cult of the feminine white mother consistently evoked throughout this space. That being said, I think it would be a mistake to assume that all they do is have children or try to have children. They are, and they have been, again, going back, you know, to the post-Civil War period, they have been fundraisers. They have been propagandists. They have been, you know, just really, really vital actors in every facet of the movement. You know, one of the people who really helped the KKK resurge in that post-World War I period was a woman. She started a newspaper. She started a recruitment program. She was profiled in the New York Times. I mean, she was, you know, this big deal in the organization. And, you know, similarly today, there are, and again, Lana Lochtef is a good example. You know, there are women who have a very large and far-reaching platform to spread these ideas. So that isn't to say, like, they do talk about motherhood a lot, and they think motherhood is very important. And they also think that, you know, being a wife is, or being a partner is a very important part of this, of being part of this movement. But they also see that as, it's almost like a microcosm of their racial responsibility. So they, you know, as wives and mothers, they are keepers of the home, but they are also keepers of the race. They are keepers of the future. Like women do in so many facets of life, they wear a lot of hats and they juggle a lot. And I think the last thing I'll say about the roles that women play is that consistently over time, and this gets back to something you said at the beginning, your first comment about Red Ice, how, you know, it mixes white nationalism and white genocide conspiracy theories with, you know, other fare. They have often served as very important bridges to the mainstream or to other potential, you know, cultural groups or trends that are good recruitment grounds. And so, you know, whether it's the PTA or, you know, some kind of community group, or again, just, you know, content on the internet, that they can mix in this, you know, the conspiracy theories that drive white nationalism with things that seem mundane, seem anodyne, seem harmless. And what that allows them to do is, first of all, reach a, you know, wide audience. Right. But also it allows them, when people say, oh, you know, you're a white nationalist, you're a racist, they can just say, what do you mean? Like, I'm just a nice white woman with, you know, interests and friends. And, you know, it's a shield, essentially. Like, they're able to wear the fact of their womanhood and their femininity as a shield, even though at the same time it's a beacon inviting people to them. And that's something that you see consistently over, you know, the last 150 years.
There's a couple of things that I'm really struck by in what you've written about. I mean, one, I should say, just to that point that you were talking about, one of the women that you focus on, Alia Stewart, who was a former feminist and then became a Mormon and a, well, I guess what is known as a trad wife, which is not a movement that I was familiar with. But she has, I checked out her Instagram account. I think it was hers. And it's wife with purpose, right? A wife with a purpose. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it just struck me as, because you also write that hate is a social bond, and mm-hmm. and as opposed to an ideology, it is a mechanism in which to it's an organizing principle that allows people to achieve, you know, whatever their goals are on some level. And it reminds me of, it was that Errol Morris film, Mr. Death, about this guy who, Fred Lecter, I think his name was, who was involved as a consultant about gas using for capital punishment in this country. And he said something that was taken as almost Holocaust denial, and then he was completely adopted by these Holocaust denial groups, and he just became more and more enthralled with this positive feedback that he was getting. And it was like, all of a sudden he was a popular guy, and it almost, you know, there were, I think, allusions to Eichmann and the idea that, like, oh my God, I've got an in-group and I'm a celebrity, but I actually have a sense of purpose on some level. And how much of that is shared across genders? Like, I mean, it's like when you enter in with that notion of wanting a social bond or wanting a sense of purpose, wanting a sense of belonging, because a lot of the women that you, or at least two of the women, I think you could easily classify as like a seeker, right? How much of that is gendered, or is it just, there's really not a significant difference between the way that people enter into these things?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. And, you know, I obviously focused my research really intensely on women. And so I don't have as much insight into men, but I will say this, like, the sociology of hate, you know, which is a small field, relatively speaking, but the consistent feeling is that there is no pattern. There is no way to predict, you know, who exactly will get involved in this space. What is clear is that, yes, people are seeking something, they have a need, And I think that that is shared across genders. So, you know, I think that men get involved in this space because they're angry and want to have their anger justified, or they too are looking for a sense of purpose, or they too are looking for power or whatever it may be, you know, having a platform, having a voice. And I think that that is the same, you know, for men and women. The exact mechanisms of how that happens might be different. Right. You know, the venues in which, you know, men might find a social bond and women might find a social bond, because the far right is such a, you know, sexist space where, you know, men are in charge or supposed to be in charge, and, you know, women are considered lesser than to a certain extent. That necessarily means that the venues in which people, or the conduits, I should say, that people find themselves in, or place themselves in, might be different depending on gender. But it really is hard. One of my favorite quotes, I mean, it's a dispiriting quote, but it says a lot, is that there's a sociologist named Kathleen Blee who's written about organized racism for the last several decades. And she was quoted in the New York Times, I think in the 90s, when someone asked her a question, you know, is there any way to tell who's going to get involved in a hate group, or in hate as a movement? And she said that would be reassuring, or something along those, or comforting. That would be comforting.
Right.
Because I think it would, if we were able to say, aha, like, here is how we can predict all of, you know, who will do what and how they will do it. But it's a very individualized, I mean, frankly, self-interested process. And that makes it very tricky to unpack, you know, beyond some sort of general parameters.
All right. So let's talk about a little bit about these specific. How did you find, first of all, how much cooperation did you have from all three of them? From what I understand, you had more cooperation, obviously, for, you know, in terms in total from the magazine piece. And then they were a little bit less inclined. But walk us through, well, maybe you should just introduce to us the three women. I mean, we've sort of touched on them. I don't know if we've mentioned Corinna mm-hmm. Olson's name, but just tell us the three women that you profiled and why those three women.
Sure. So Corinna Olson is the first woman in the book. And the book, I should say, is divided. The way it's organized is around these three stories. So it's basically in three big sections. And Corinna Olson is the first woman, and she is from the Pacific Northwest, and was she radicalized in like the 2008-2009 period. So before, you know, the alt-right was even a thing that white nationalism was calling itself. And she was a person who'd really struggled her whole life to find community, to make friends. She is just a person who seems uncomfortable in her own skin. I spent a good bit of time with her, and I think she would say that. ultimately also suffered a loss of a loved one and the end of a marriage, and then you know, found herself on the internet, and finding new friends in the white nationalist space. And I think that her story is so interesting. Well, I mean, it's interesting in any number of ways, but one of the things I found most telling about the way that she ultimately got into this is that she had just never had to think very hard about race. And I think that this is something that goes back to what you said about, you know, whiteness as normal, whiteness as, you know, baseline. That means that you've never really had to think critically in any way about being white. And so when people on Stormfront, which is the oldest venue for communications about hate on the internet, when they started saying things to her about what it meant to be a white person, she didn't have anything to compare that to. And I think that made it, that plus the, you know, people telling her that she was great and that they wanted to be her friend, that made the whole thing very alluring to her.
That's what reminded me of the Dr. Death. This idea that like, oh, exactly. My God, I'm going to step into a whole clique where I'm the new kid in school and everybody really likes me.
Right. Exactly. And she was in it for a couple of years and kind of went between some different groups, and then ultimately actually left the movement. And so her story is unique because it follows this whole arc of her radicalizing and then de-radicalizing. And she left the space, actually became an FBI informant for a little while with regard to one particular white nationalist group. And then I don't want to give away the ultimate ending for Corinna because it's an interesting one. in the book. But yeah, so she was very, very cooperative with my work for understandable reasons, because, you know, she's left it and she, I think, wants to share her story. And I don't know if I would say that she's seeking penance by telling her story exactly, but she was just more forthcoming and clear-eyed about, you know, the choices she had made. And then the second woman is Ayla Stewart, and Ayla is better known as Wife with a Purpose. She, for a time, I remember the first time I contacted the Southern Poverty Law Center, actually, and this was when I was still working on just the very beginnings of the Harper's piece. I said, you know, who are women that you guys are tracking? And they were like, we're not really tracking much of any, but they did mention Ayla. And I think it's because at that time, this was early 2017, and she had a couple of viral videos, anti-feminist videos, and then made headlines because she issued something on Twitter called the White Baby Challenge, where she said, I've had six, like, match or beat me. So she's a big advocate of trad life or traditional lifestyle. And so this idea that it's a hashtag, frankly. And so it's an aesthetic thing. It's, you know, wearing traditional garb, you know, living a more organic lifestyle, but also, you know, going back to this sort of mythological idea of what it means to be a white person, and to embrace one's, like, white roots and white heritage. And so she became a big proponent of that. And she was cooperative to a certain, I mean, she was perfectly cooperative during the Harper's piece, when I was reporting it. And then, afterward, decided she didn't really want to speak to me anymore. And the thing about Ayla especially is that she has been a prolific blogger and social media presence for, I guess, almost 20 years now. And so I was sort of like a historian going through archives, you know, building out a profile with, you know, the information that she was no longer willing to give me. Like, I went and found it in this archive that she has left on the internet. And she now calls herself politically retired. She got kicked off of a lot of different social media platforms. So she, you know, in that regard, didn't have a choice. But then she also has kind of slipped behind the scenes, I guess, for about a year now. That being said, I noticed in the midst of, like, the early days of the BLM protests this summer, she posted something on Gab, which is the far right Twitter, essentially. She posted something on Gab about, you know, how this is such a scary moment for the country, but, you know, turn to God and, like, turn to community and, you know, we'll all be okay. So I think she's politically retired in the sense that she's not tweeting or making videos, but it seems that her ideology remains the same. And then Lana Lochteff, I should have said about Ayla. Yes. So she once considered herself, like, a far left feminist.
And how did what was that transition? Like, what brought about that transition? Was there, I mean, in the case of Karina, it feels like the sort of inciting event, if you will, was the death of her brother. And that it, you know, I mean, throughout one's life, you run into moments where you question things, or you feel a little bit untethered. And what was there one like that for that you could discern anyways in Stewart's, like, moment of radicalization?
Yeah, I don't think that there was a single event, and I don't think that there ever is for anybody. I mean, yes, I think with Karina, you know, she certainly, like, her brother's death was something that, like, led her to start seeking certain answers and narratives in her life. But there were other factors, you know, that kind of led right. her to do that. And with Ayla, I think that, you know, I spoke to a number of people who knew her when she was in graduate school studying women's spirituality. And, you know, when she really considered herself a feminist, and she was pro-immigration. She was anti-death penalty, you know, basically all the things that she is not now. And I think that in her case, the way people described her is that she was always a seeker, but she was also a person who, like, what she was seeking was to stand out. That, you know, she wanted to be a role model. She wanted to be someone who people really responded to, who people really saw. And I think that she wasn't finding that anymore, or hadn't ever found it in the sort of feminist space that she inhabited, I think in her personal life, but then also on the internet. And then I think too, you know, she had chosen to have a large family, and she felt like there was a certain sector of like the feminist tradition. I don't know exactly, because I think her definition of feminism is really quite different than my definition of feminism, but she felt like feminism was telling her that, and feminists she knew were telling her that having a lot of children is bad, that, you know, she should be having a career, she should be, you know, not shaving her legs, whatever, like all of these kind of stereotypes about feminism. And I think more than anything, if you, again, like peel back layers there, she was also going through like a hard time financially. She did have a large family and not a lot of money. And I think that, you know, it's a confluence of a lot of different factors, right, where she ultimately decided that feminism had betrayed her. And she also, you know, converted to, like you said, to Mormonism within this time, you know, decided that that was a path she wanted to follow. And along the way was just constantly seeking to carve out this status as role model. And I was really struck at one point, I read on her website, I want to say in the course of my research, that she had added something where she called what she did a ministry. And I think that's certainly, like, there's the religious sense in that word, because she is a religious person. But I think also it's just that idea that you have something, that you are a person that other people want to minister to them, you know? And so this like sense of self and this sense of status that ultimately, you know, getting into white nationalism allowed her. And then the final woman is Lana Wachtess. And Lana is a person who I think has always been interested in fringy ideas. She, you know, grew up in the Pacific Northwest as well, actually, and told me, you know, she listened to Coast to Coast, and was very
interested. We should just tell people Coast to Coast was formerly hosted by Art Bell. I can't remember who the latest host was, but this is sort of UFO, right. UFOs and maybe interterrestrials, right, and stuff like that.
Right. And definitely conspiracy theories. And actually, I found an episode from the 90s where a prominent white nationalist was on the program, like talking about his beliefs. So so she was always very interested in conspiracies and just that kind of that world. But she was also, she was into music. She told me she was briefly a model, and was somebody who, you know, again, like I think was interested in status and power. And so she ultimately found and married her still husband, who ran a conspiracy theory radio program, blog, and got into doing that with him. It's sort of like InfoWars, but even more grassroots,
yep.
Just run by the two of them. And then I think, frankly, that she saw an opportunity within the, you know, 2012 to 2014 period, where they had some guests on who talked about how multiculturalism was dangerous and a conspiracy, you know, against Europeans and things like that. But they were not, like, Red Ice was not a strictly white nationalist platform at all. And then in 2014, Lana hosted this one episode where she gave this long monologue about how, you know, she was done acting like there wasn't an anti-white agenda. And after that, the platform shifted pretty notably toward white nationalism. And I think it's because, again, there was that upswell of interest in white nationalism in the 2012 to 2014 period. Part of that was because of, you know, still Obama's being in office, but then also, you know, the advent of Black Lives Matter. And I think she saw a chance to carve a place out for herself in the conspiracy theorizing world, and then got a lot of attention for it. Made friends with people like Richard Spencer of the National Policy Institute, perhaps most famous for getting punched in the face on camera.
Yep.
And launching 1,000, you know, punch a Nazi memes. And so again, yes, I think to your point, like there was this accrual of attention and affirmation. And she and her husband continue to run this platform. They're based in Virginia now. And Red Ice is still, it actually only got banned from Facebook, I want to say last fall. It took a long time for and they've been, they're still on Twitter. So, those are the three women. Lana was cooperative in an interesting way. She's very cooperative for the Harper's piece. I met her in person. She gave me, you know, lots of time. And we spoke on the phone as well. And she always answered emails and DMs and things like that. And then after the Harper's piece came out, she publicly, like in a video, said that it was a bunch of lies, which it was not, to be clear. But then she would still respond to messages that I sent her and answer questions that I asked her. It was actually only when my fact checker, I think, for the book contacted her that Lana, like, blocked me on social media and, you know, doesn't want anything to do with me. So she had been coy, I guess, about engaging. As I say in the conclusion of the book, I think that the refusal or, you know, disinterest in engaging with this research by people on the far right is such an important part of the story because they have their own platforms. They just have unlimited resources on the internet for where they can communicate and, you know, build brands and things like that. And so I will never forget, I read a comment on, I think it was on one of Lana's videos, but maybe it was Ayla. But anyway, on YouTube, somebody wrote, "We don't need the media, we're our own media now." And I think that that's just such an important thing to keep in mind, especially when we're talking about, should we cover the far right? How should we cover the far right? Like, we definitely should because it exists, right? And it's important to cover it. But we should also not think of that as giving it a platform, because that is not the platform that they are interested in. They have their own platforms that they can control.
Right. I wanted to get into, like, I mean, my sense was that she was seeing benefit in being written about in a magazine, which she could then sort of, you know, leverage and talk about how she's being written about in a magazine, and sort of weave that into a narrative. But having a sort of like long form, actually sort of critique on some level, she didn't want to be dissected in the same way.
No, not at all.
And none of her people are going to read a book. It's one thing to sort of see the magazine, but it's another to be like a subject in a book in terms of like how you leverage that on a YouTube show.
True to a certain extent. But I also think, you know, after the Harper's piece, the video that she and her husband made where they talked about the piece, the very first thing they said about it as a criticism was, "Oh my gosh, it's like 7 or 8 pages long." Like, that was seen as, you know, it was sort of dismissive. But also, I think the point was, don't bother to read it.
Right.
Because it was critical, right? Like, it was, you know, I didn't have nearly as much space as I do in the book to be critical and make the points I want to make. But it is not a positive piece. You know, by saying like, it's just ridiculous and so long, like, don't bother. And then they proceeded to say things that were not true about it. This is the thing, like, they are stage managers, and they are propagandists, and they're very good at keeping the narrative as they want it to be.
How much does from you know, this is a limited sample, and I don't know if this is really the proper question, but like, you know, Does economic anxiety like play into this in some fashion, or is it just one factor of maybe the various anxieties that they and maybe, I don't know. I mean, you know, I don't know if we could describe like Lana Lotkin's sort of desire to be a celebrity on some level as an anxiety. I mean, it's certainly like an itch to be scratched, I guess. Is it specifically about economic anxiety, or is it just sort of like the general anxieties that everybody has? It just so happens that these people did not have, I mean, you know, and this gets back to that question where it's like, it would be comforting to have be able to do a profile, but it feels like, you know, from person to person, everybody has these anxieties, and maybe different times in your life, you're seeking something or you want some sense of purpose or meaning to your life. And some people have these sort of like blockers that say, "Oh, this is not the path I'm going to go down. I'm exposed to it. I'm online. My algorithm takes me to a video of Lana Lotkin, but I watch it and I'm like, no, not for me. Is a path I follow." I mean, what's your sense of that? Or you know, maybe again, we're just back at that. It would be comforting to know, but there isn't it's even a general expression of that.
Yeah, no, I think that's a, because I mean, certainly this is something I wrestled with, that, you know, there've been plenty of times in my own life, just like in anybody's life, where, you know, I've been trying to figure things out, make sense of things, you know, whatever. And if I landed on, I mean, first of all, I wouldn't like go on YouTube looking for answers, but, you know, even if I did, you know, landed on one of these videos, I would be like, well, this is racist. That is not for me. But I think the key thing too, is just to remember that, and I frequently had to do this, is like, but put yourself in the shoes of somebody who has never really thought that seriously about this issue. And the other thing to remember, and again, I think I said this earlier in our conversation, that the things that the far right believes are just magnifications, amplifications of white supremacy. That is, you know, the bedrock of right. like the American experience. And so when they find these videos, I think oftentimes here are people who are saying exactly what maybe they have been feeling, and it, they're putting it into words. And I mean, this is something that people talk about a lot with regard to Trump being elected, right? You know, the number of times that at rallies, supporters were interviewed by, you know, newspaper reporters or whatever, saying, oh yeah, you know, he's saying everything I believe, or he's saying everything that I feel. And I think that that is something that the far right is very good at, is tapping into, well, here are maybe the things you've been told are not polite to say, but you're feeling them and your feelings are valid. And so I think that, you know, there are just a lot of white Americans. And the other thing to your economic anxiety point, you know, profile wise, people who get involved in this space come from across the spectrum. Like, yes, there are people who, you know, I think kind of find it in a moment of uncertainty, you know, about jobs or, you know, their future or whatever. But it's definitely not true that these are all, you know, poor people or all people from the South or something else that kind of plays into these stereotypes. They can come, somebody described it, as like a cross section of white America, essentially, you know, is who's involved in this space. And so, yeah, I think that, you know, it's just this almost unknowable confluence of factors that brings someone to the point where they say, oh, actually, this is going to offer me the thing that I am looking for.
Right.
But I think it's always, always, always important to remember the bedrock upon which they're standing. You know, and I think in the book, I call it the communal well of white supremacy. I think we often think of the far right as not in some way associated with the mainstream, but that's not true.
Well, you know, on that point, what I'm struck by is, you know, you said that Alia, I can't pronounce her name, Stewart.
It's okay, Ayla.
Alia was just talking about, like, you know, I just want what's best for my children, my white children. And, mm-hmm. you know, when you delve into sort of white supremacy as a practice that we practice, and by we, I mean, you know, everyone on some level in the country practices. In the case of, you know, me, like I want to move into a neighborhood where there's a good school, and I'm just doing that for my children. I'm, you know, on some level, without a lot of digging, I can reduce that down to, like, well, what do I mean by a good neighborhood and a good school? It means that I am,
yep.
in some ways, saying that, like, you know, the school that other people send their kids to, that's their problem. I have the ability to send my, you know, kids to a better school because I'm in this neighborhood. You know, on some level, as a conscious human being, that is going to weigh on me, and I am going to have to live with that contradiction. And then all of a sudden I get the message mm-hmm. that says, like, hey, you don't need to have that sort of like nagging feeling that maybe you're doing something wrong. Here I am to tell you that those feelings are absolutely fine, and this is binary, and you don't have to have any type of nuance. You don't have to have any self-doubt in there. You can live your best life, I guess, without any of that.
Yep.
The one other point too that I just wanted to that you mentioned in passing, which I found sort of fascinating, that when you went to the Southern Law Poverty Center, asking like what women are they tracking. They weren't. And I wonder the reasons why they don't, because they're looking obviously for what they perceive as going to be something that's going to be more violent or going to have an impact. If that isn't the value of a lot of women within this movement, is that they are seen as less threatening.
Yes. Well, I would say two things. Because first of all, I don't want to suggest that the Southern Poverty Law Center is like failing on this front. This was early 2017, and I was very specifically asking about women of the alt-right as that little, you know, cohort of the far right describes themselves. And so I've taken to calling them like digital neo-fascists, essentially. And, you know, the Southern Poverty Law Center has lots of profiles of various prominent white nationalists, and there are women on the website. So I just want to be clear on that front because I don't want to dig at them and the work that they do.
Right.
But yes, 100% about the non-threatening thing. I think that that is such an important point. And Lana, even one of the very first times I ever heard her speak, it was a YouTube video of her speaking at a conference in early 2017 in Sweden. And she says, you know, because women are soft, we can get away with saying hard things. And I think that it's sexism in its own way, right? Like that women are seen as somehow less impactful, less threatening, and they can use that to their advantage. And I think they have and they do. And that's why, I mean, the deeper and deeper I got into this research, I, again, found ways that women have been doing that for a long time in a lot of different scenarios and, you know, different iterations of white nationalism. And the other thing that's scary about it is the ways in which if women have done bad things, been involved in this space, you know, potentially even been violent actors in this space, they get written out of the history over time, which, you know, is a trend we see all the time. Like if you don't apply a feminist lens to history, you know, the mainstream view of things often forgets women's contributions. And that's no different than, you know, no different with the far right than it is with pretty much anything else. And there have been some really wonderful books in the last few years from feminist historians looking back at whether we're talking about Nazi Germany or massive resistance to the civil rights movement, looking at the ways that women's contributions were integral, but then also got erased after the fact. And so, you know, these women are bad actors, but they are also like in some ways targets of sexism, not just from, you know, people in their movement who are misogynistic and are sexist, but also sort of just like the misogynistic eye of history, if you will. And I think it's so important that they not be written out, that they be seen as, you know, complete and impactful actors, because, you know, otherwise they're getting away with it, frankly.
Yeah. It's a fascinating paradox. Sayward Darby, the book is Sisters in Hate, American Women on the Front Lines of White Nationalism. We will put a link to that at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. This is a great conversation.